Coming up in this episode of An Older Gay Guy Show.
I had never done turns in second in my entire life. It turns out the role of Mephistopheles has this big number in Act Two, and in the middle of it, you do this moment where you do all these turns and turns and turns and turns, and it stops the show. I mean, it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Ladies and gentlemen, and I suppose not so gentlemen, thank you as always for joining me today. My sweeps period officially starts in 2 days. However, I'm starting to roll out those episodes today. For anyone new, I do the August sweeps period every year. That is the time that judges are evaluating the finalists for the 2020 People's Choice Podcast Awards. Now, in the two previous years, I have been a finalist. However, the big trophy has remained just out of my grasp. So this year, actually, due to the illness and death of my beloved 16-year-old Kat Nichols, I wasn't putting out enough episodes to encourage listeners to vote for An Older Gay Guy Show. So there's a very good chance that I'm not even going to be in the finals this year. But I am making a last-ditch effort to get y'all to vote for me. So please, if you enjoy An Older Gay Guy Show, you can show your appreciation by taking 5 minutes and voting. I will leave the instructions on how to vote below in the show notes, and I explain it also in my last episode, Construction Site Jackoff. Ooh, such a romantic and classy title, eh? I thank you in advance, though, for your vote. I really appreciate it. Now, in today's first sweeps period episode, it is an interview show. I know, the crowd goes wild. You don't have to listen just to me. So enjoy it while you can. And I'm putting a disclaimer out at the start of some of the interview shows. I have never liked, in fact, I actually detest interviewers who go, uh-huh, yeah, oh, ooh. It adds nothing to the conversation, and I feel it interrupts the spotlight on the person being interviewed and is just so distracting. Therefore, when I find someone that I interview that has a natural way of telling stories and moving the conversation along, I like to ask a question sometimes and then just let the person talk. That is the way I conducted my interviews with Officer Ron in the very popular Gay Prison Guard series. And today, we are fortunate to have a very interesting and intimate conversation with Randy Slavacek, who we last heard from in an interview about his podcast and blog, The Randy Report, available wherever you find your podcasts. But today is part one of a new series with Randy. Not only is he an LGBTQ news personality, he also has a long and successful career as a Broadway and touring production performer. And in today's show, I comment and ask questions, but I let Randy tell you his fascinating story as he lived it. In part one, we will learn of his beginnings and rise to principal cast member as the magical Mr. Mephistopheles in Cats. This story is inspiring for anyone that's desiring to be a performer, as well as it gives some behind-the-scenes information about Broadway productions. But the heart-stopper is a beautiful story he tells about his lesson that you never know who is out in the dark audience, and how you can impact lives. This episode is titled Randy Slavacek, Broadway Dancer, Singer, and Actor, Part 1. My name is Joey Hernandez. Thank you for joining me today. Can you tell me, when you were growing up, and you grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, when you were growing up, were you involved, actively involved in high school drama or college drama, musicals? When did all of that start actually getting in your head?
I think the first time I ever performed in front of an audience was fifth grade. There was an elementary school talent show, and I suddenly decided that I wanted to get on stage and perform, and I think I sang, actually, I was rejected. I tried out, and I was rejected, and I was upset, and the music teacher felt bad for me, so she paired me with a trio of girls, and I sang the lead on Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree by Tony Orlando and Dawn in the fifth grade in a bright yellow suit. No one would have ever guessed I was gay at that point, clearly. And in sixth grade, because I'd grown interested in music classes in elementary school, I was in music classes in middle school, and somewhere along the way, the Texas Boys Choir held auditions. Now, for those people who don't know, the Texas Boys Choir is actually, and this isn't about me bragging or something, but it's a reality, the Texas Boys Choir is one of the most acclaimed boys choirs in the world. Like the Vienna Boys Choir, the Texas Boys Choir, huge, huge fame. And so it was located in Fort Worth, Texas, where I grew up. And I tried out. And this is back when I had no fear whatsoever. The world had not beat me down yet at all. And I remember we had to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And I went first at these open auditions in front of other kids and parents. And I just belted that out because I had no idea that I'm supposed to be scared of life. And they cast me, I guess that's what we'd say back then. And it was over 3 years that I was in the Texas Boys Choir. And the first year, you're like in a training choir. The second year, you performed around the area. And then my third year during eighth grade, I actually toured the United States in like 40 states with a touring choir and doing one-nighters on a bus, performing in huge, beautiful performing arts centers. And I liked singing. I think later when I got older, I realized I was a fan of Donny Osmond back then because Donny Osmond was wholesome and loved by everyone. I think I thought if I sang and performed, people would love me too. I think I figured that out later in life. But I liked singing, and singing was fun. And I get to high school, and I think at the end of my freshman year, I wasn't in choirs or music classes yet, and they announced auditions for the spring musical, and I think it was either my freshman or sophomore year, and they did Gypsy, the Julie Stein, Stephen Sondheim musical, which, by the way, is the best written musical in the history of the musical theater, period, in my opinion. I think it's a brilliant musical, and I was cast as one of the chorus boys, and I was hooked, and someone said, oh, well, you know, you move really well. You should take dance classes, and I thought, dance classes? I want to be a singer and an actor. And at the time, the regional theater in Fort Worth, Casa Manana, had like after-school kids classes, and there was a dance class. A girl who was a friend of mine took the classes, and she said, oh, you should come with me. So I go. I was terrible. I couldn't remember anything. This is the irony. There's an irony in this story that I would not remember the next step. And a hallmark of my career years later was while I may or may not have been in one of the best dancers in a company, whether it was a chorus line or Hello Dolly or something. I'm not going to say I was the best at anything, but I would have a memory. To this day, I can remember the entire Jellicle Ball from Cats that I did in 1986. To this day, I remember every single step from memory from a chorus line. But back then, I couldn't remember anything. And I had to look at everyone else. And there was like, at the end of the school year, there was a kind of recital thing. And parents came. And I was in that. And from there, I started taking dance classes with that same dance teacher at his own dance studio. He danced on Broadway. And he'd come back home to Fort Worth to open his dance studio. And I started dancing. So my sophomore, junior, and senior year of high school, I danced. And it became clear that dancing like athletics for some people, dancing for me was a gift. I'm not going to say, oh, I'm wonderful and look how talented I am. I had a natural ability to dance. And I had to work really hard to kind of keep up with others because other people would work really hard on technical aspects, you know, like a lot of athletes will do. And they'll have really, really good technical approach to either the long jump or the shot put or track and field. Sometimes when things come easy for you as a natural talent, you can kind of take it for granted. And I learned early on, don't take this for granted because you're not going to be the best. You're going to, I would tell people later, I could always get a B plus really easy kind of a thing. Like a B plus always came easy. But if I wanted to be in the top tier of anything, I had to work really hard because that little thing could fool me. And I think for some people in life, that's a similar thing is, you know, anytime something comes easy, don't get trapped in that little equation. And then I went off to school. I started auditioning for musical theater programs, and I auditioned at several universities like SMU and TCU and, oh God, a lot of schools. And acting programs accepted me, dance programs accepted me, which amazed me. And along the way, they would say, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to do musical theater. Three or four schools at the time, this was in the mid-80s, said, well, if you want to do musical theater, you should go to Syracuse University because the music theater program at Syracuse University is the best right now. So I look into it, find out that week on Friday, it was like March of 1981. Oh my God. There was an audition. The last audition, you had to audition to get in Syracuse University. I go to my dad, and I'm like, Dad, there's this audition. And at this point, he's used to me auditioning for things. He's like, well, go, son. Well, it's in Syracuse, New York. And he's like, what? And by the way, he's packing the car to go skiing in Colorado with my brother. So he's like, oh, son, can't you do it next week? And I'm like, no, the audition's this week. So he just gave me his credit card, and he said, well, go. So at 17, I flew myself up to New York, at Syracuse, New York, and I found the campus and I found the school and I did a monologue and I danced and I sang and they accepted me and I ended up getting a BFA in musical theater from Syracuse University with Vanessa Williams.
On auditions though, I did auditions at Boston Conservatory of Music and New England Conservatory of Music. My way of getting in to the musical theater department, not being the best actor and not being the best dancer, was I started out as a voice major, and then I changed my major to musical theater when the voice department was kind of like, okay, well, maybe you should try that out before we kick you out. So you went up to Syracuse and you brought your music and you were going to be working with an accompanist that you had never worked with before. You know, usually when you go to a local school, you bring your own person that you're used to working with. Did that throw you off? How did you feel about that?
You know, back then, I guess I was just happy that they played. You know, I had to do two songs. I had to do a monologue. I had to prepare a dance, of all things. And I had to play the piano, which I did a little bit. So I guess I just put that sheet music down in front of someone and said, you know, like this. And of course, they're a music theater major that probably played for me. And they knew the song and got, what an idiot I was, like trying to explain what it was when they're already majoring in this. So, but no, I was just putting one foot in front of the other. And the fact that at 17, I got to DFW Airport, got up to Syracuse, took a cab to the university, checked myself into a hotel. I mean, I listened back to this. And my dad didn't go. Even when I got accepted and went to school in the fall of 1981, my dad didn't go with me to like set me up in a dorm or anything. You know, when I got to Syracuse, everyone's parents were with them checking in and blah, blah, blah. Oh, no, not me. Like my dad's like, good luck, son. You'll be good. That was it. And I didn't go home. You know how you go home during the weekends or something or after a couple of weeks? I did not go home until Christmas.
Did you feel comfortable there?
It was a whole new world, Joey. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. And first of all, it snowed the first week of October. Freaked me out. We barely had snow in Texas. And when we thought we had snow, it was actually an ice storm. And we would go out and we would ball up ice and throw it at each other thinking this was snow and ooh, this is fun. It's Syracuse. Oh my, and it was the worst winter ever.
Okay, so you stayed there for 4 years. And as you are concluding your time there, as maybe towards the end of the first semester of your senior year, does one then begin to think about auditioning for shows? Would you be allowed to do that if you wanted to do that?
You know, what a great question, because one of the few things that Syracuse did not prepare me for at the time was to go to New York City and compete for a job. I knew how to audition. I had like 8 songs that I had worked on in class, and I knew how to audition. I knew how to dress for an audition. I knew how to dance to my best ability. I knew how to act or make choices. But no one ever talked about the actual business of show business and going to New York, getting an apartment in New York. What was I thinking? I just moved. I went home for the summer. I did a chorus line at my local theater, Casa Manana, where I had done my first dance lessons. I did a chorus line. And when that was over, I packed up with my best friend, Carly, and we just moved to New York City. Dun, 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 dun. Like, it's going to be this easy. And I show up in New York City. I'll tell you what, we kept driving around looking for an apartment. And for kids from Fort Worth, Texas, if you're not from New York City, which is a totally different environment, we kept looking around for the nice part of town or the regular part of town. And then, Joey, we were on the Upper West Side. So we were in the normal part. We were in like the middle class part of town. We couldn't tell anything. At one point, we looked at an apartment in Brooklyn Heights, which is nice. And our friends talked us out of it. And we ended up renting an apartment on the Upper West Side at 96th and Broadway. 2 months later, our friend's friend that we roomed with threw us out at midnight on October 30th, 1985. We were homeless. We slept in the park. And we just knew nothing. He took our deposit. We had no money. We were going to head home. And a friend said, no, you can't do that. And at this point, he threw us out because we were moving out because we'd found this 6-floor walk-up on the Upper East Side, 73rd and York. 6-floor walk-up. They exist. And we're moving out at the end of October, early November. And a friend gave us the money to do the deposit. And he said, you can't go home. You'll never come back. Go do this, blah, blah, blah. So we rent this 6-floor walk-up, which if you are from the Midwest or you're from anywhere else, 6-floor walk-up. Let me tell you what, when you go downstairs to go to work or go somewhere, if you forget something, you just decide you're going to buy another one because you're not walking up 6 flights of stairs again to go get it. So yeah, it was rough moving to New York. I wasn't prepared for the business of the business. I wasn't prepared for being an adult in a city, but my father had never taught me fear. And so I just went and I just start going to auditions. You know, back then you would buy Backstage, which was the trade paper. And I just went to auditions. And for a year, it was an interesting thing. I would do well at some auditions, not so great at others, but I was doing really well. And I would get to the ends of some things, including some new Broadway shows. But what I'd find out later is casting directors who organize auditions especially for Broadway shows and off-Broadway shows, know people. And so when, first of all, there are invited calls for the known quantities, the dancers that everyone knows, the dancers that are on Broadway at the time, the actors that are on Broadway. So they get appointments, they get a private audition, they get a private call, blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm just a kid from Texas. So I'm going to the open calls and I'm doing well. The choreographers like me. I learned later that casting directors who didn't know me weren't really fighting for me because there were other actors they knew. There were other dancers they knew that they did know. And, you know, hey, this is Scott Wise, who's been in 5 Broadway shows. This is who we should hire. This is, you know, Randy Slovacek or Slava or whoever he is. You know, we don't know him. He's good, but yeah, we don't know him. So when you would dance and they'd kind of hash things out, you'd be sitting at the back of the room, they'd hash things out. And I would get to the final cut of things, but I wouldn't get the job for like a year because just nobody knew me. And there's kind of have to pay your dues in terms of auditioning. And over the course of a year, casting directors slowly got to know me. And the people at Johnson Lift Casting, who handled Cats, I went to an open call, I want to say in February of 1986. to replace an understudy in the national tour of Cats that was out. And one of the roles they had to cover was the magical Mr. Mistopheles, who's one of the leads. So I did well, but they didn't know me, so I got cut. I went home. And the next day, they called, and they had a card with my phone number, but they said, we didn't get your picture and resume. Would you send us one? Because we'd like to put you on file. Well, Joey, my head exploded. I thought, wow, of course. Yeah, I mean, I practically ran it to the mailbox. So about 2 months later, there was an open call for a brand new production of Cats. It was technically the second national touring company, but the first national sat in Boston for a year, sat in Chicago for a year, sat in San Francisco for a year, kind of thing like that, Washington. This new company was going to do 2 or 3 weeks in Dallas, 2 or 3 weeks in Atlanta, 2 or 3 weeks in Miami. So this is going to be a company that America actually sees. And so I go to the open call. They didn't call, by the way. I sent the headshot in and everything. They didn't call. So I don't know what happened to it. So I go to the call, and I did the same combination that they gave us before. I remembered it. See, my memory is getting better. So I did it. And this is back when you literally auditioned on the stage of a Broadway theater. The casting people would rent. I think it was on the stage of the Court Theater, which is like, what, 51st and Broadway or something? And there's like 40 guys on stage at any given time. They went through several groups of 40 guys. It's an open call. And I dance, and they said, we want all the guys who tumble to stay, do gymnastics, and Randy. I'm like, what? And now a funny aside here is, by this point, I had my equity card, my union card, Actors Equity Association, and I got it doing West Side Story at Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera the year before, at this point, 2 years before, in 1984. And two of the people in the ensemble with me were Kathleen Marshall, Tony Award-winning choreographer today, and Rob Ashford, two-time a Tony Award-winning choreographer. So I'm at this audition with Rob Ashford, because it's a male audition, and Rob was a beautiful, beautiful dancer and nice, super great guy. Although we went through a period where we thought the other didn't like each other, so we kind of like, it was like not friendly, but we figured it out later, which is a whole story. But he gets cut. I go under the stage to the basement while the gymnasts are tumbling, and you can hear them like pounding on the stage above us. And Rob, who's been cut, and later I found out he only got cut because my company of Cats, which I eventually got, I'll end the mystery, they had cut two characters, and the character they saw him as was the one they were cutting. Anyway, Rob wasn't happy he'd been cut, but he walked up to me, and this is one of the nicest things. I want to say nice things about people in show business because you hear about the catty stuff. Rob Ashford, who thinks he doesn't like me, and to this day we're friends, walks up and says, because I don't know what they're going to ask me to do. He says, they're going to ask you to do turns in second. And I think he instinctively knew Randy Slavacek has no idea what that is. And so he tells me, you're going to put your feet in fifth position, out to second, to fourth position, do a double pirouette, put your leg out in second, your arms in second, and you're going to turn. Use your plie. I always remember to this day, use your plie. I had never done turns in second in my entire life. It turns out the role of Mistopheles has this big number in Act Two, and in the middle of it, you do this moment where you do all these turns and turns and turns and turns, and it stops the show. I mean, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. They eventually, on Broadway, this was done by ballet soloists from New York City Ballet. And Joey, they're asking me. So I have never done this in my life. But my whole life, I've said, if you show me how to do something, I can try. So Rob said, plie, fifth, second, fourth, double pirouette. So I go up there, and the dance supervisor says, you know, we want you to do turns in second. I'm like, oh, see you around. All right. They show me what they did. It was exactly what Rob said. I have never done this in my life. And I pretended. I just pretended. And I somehow did it good enough that they called me back. I went through 5 callbacks over the next 3 months. They would call me back. We'd go through all the dance combinations again. At one audition, there were 2 other guys who were considering for Mistopheles. They'd call us out on stage at the Court Theater all by yourself, staring out at an empty audience in a Broadway theater. It was like so cool. And I remember one time the dance supervisor said, Randy, I did it. Went to the wings. The other guy, he calls me back out on stage. He comes up on stage, he goes, okay, now do it again. Like, make sure you don't drop your spot down to the floor because you're going to fall. Like, look up. Like, he's teaching me how to do this. They hired me for the role.
Wow. Oh, my God.
I was living in an apartment with no furniture. We slept on the floor. We ate on the floor. And I remember looking up at Carly when I got the call, and I didn't even say it because we thought I might be a swing or an understudy or something. They called, and I just looked up, and she starts screaming. Just screaming. We have been saved. It was a year of incredible struggle. We are waiting tables. And at one point in the middle of this audition period, they don't do this now that I know of, but around audition 3, the dance supervisor called me to the edge of the stage and said, are you in class? Dance class. And I said, no. And he goes, why not? And I had to admit to a stranger that I didn't have the money to do it. And he said, then we will. So they paid for me to be in class every day. But to be in class every day, I couldn't get a job and help pay the bills. So Carly got a temp job, and she was waiting tables. She would get up at 5 in the morning, take the train in. We were living in Jersey City at the time. She'd take the train in. She would work a temp job from 9 to 5. I would go to dance class in the middle of the day. She would go to her table waiting job and wait tables from 5:30 until 11, and then come home and do that 5 days a week so that I could be in dance class. And fortunately, it all paid off. I mean, it's when people talk about going to New York and struggling and just not knowing anything, we knew nothing, but Cats happened, and it saved and changed our lives. That was my first big gig out of New York City.
Let me stop you and back you up a little bit because I want to ask you a few questions. You talked about them requesting your resume and headshot. How did that come about? Did you have a headshot done in Texas before you went to New York in anticipation of needing one, or did you do that once you got to New York?
As I recall, my spring semester of my senior year in college, a photographer came to Syracuse University and we did headshots for like $50. And I just found it recently. It's terrible. I can send it to you. It was what they did back then. So I had that headshot and I'd at least seen resumes. So I knew how to type one up. And so this is back when you literally used a typewriter to space things out and type them in the format of a resume. And you'd go to Kinko's and get copies of your headshot and then you'd staple them together back to back. And oh, it was also rinky dink. That's what we did back in the day.
And you mentioned at some point you had your equity card up to the point where we are at in your career explained so far. Is this all without a manager or an agent of any type?
So when I get to New York, I don't have a manager. I don't have an agent. I don't even know how to get one. I do have my equity card, which I had earned back in Pittsburgh and the year before I moved to New York doing West Side Story, but no manager, no agent, nobody would be interested in me. You know, we would do mailings back in the day. I would get a list of agents or managers and you would write a cover letter and put your picture and resume in. Well, at this point, I have 3 professional credits, Oklahoma City Lyric Theater, West Side Story at Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera, and a chorus line at Cosmonaut. I had 3 credits. No one wanted to put time into me. As a matter of fact, none of my jobs ever on Broadway or national touring companies were ever secured by a manager or an agent. I had managers or agents that back in the day, what would you say? We would freelance with them or you wouldn't sign with them, but they would supposedly include you in their pitches for auditions. The only thing that ever worked in my favor was that I went to open calls. I didn't wait to be one of the elite. Because I wasn't. And I would do the mailings to managers and agents, but no one was interested. Along the way, I guess, over my entire career, there was a time when there was this agent that said, hey, I'll freelance with you or that one. But no one ever got me a job. No one really fought for me. And I will say, it certainly would have been a huge help. If I had so many friends that did have managers and agents, and they were the hot properties in town, and you know they were in Broadway shows. If you were in a Broadway show, you could get a manager and agent, but I wasn't, so it just never happened for me. Every show I ever got, I went to an open call. So anyone listening, don't think you need that agent. You can work. Just go to the open call. The interesting thing about open calls is someone once said to me, well, I'm not going to an open call. But the funny thing about an open call, if you're good, if you keep your skills up, because I did keep my skills up. I learned my lesson and would go to dance class and I would take voice lessons when I could afford it. If you keep your skills up and you go to open calls and you're good, if you're talented, it's kind of like the cream rising to the top. It kind of helps you. If I had only been going to private calls with all of the best of Broadway, it's very possible I'd have never been noticed. I might have been in the middle of everything. I might have been just the median. But when I was at an open call, okay, will afford me 10 seconds of ego. I was pretty good. And I would stand out at an open call, but I don't know that I might have. So what would happen is I'd go to an open call, get called back, and that's when I would dance with the people who were called back from the private, elite, invited calls. But by then, they had an impression of me, and it was good. And so that helped me in a way, kind of, sort of.
So without an agent or manager, were you completely restricted to only being able to go to open calls?
Yes. Oh, and it's just... And you know what, Joey, what's funny is what I learned, and I have this to this day, is I developed a sense of humor. One beautiful thing about open calls, I will say this, is especially for dance calls, because they would have like the dance call either at 10 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon, either the women in the morning or the men in the afternoon or vice versa. A lot of times they would let the women come in the afternoon so that women didn't have to get up at 6 in the morning and do their hair and makeup and look gorgeous, because that's what girls do, because they are gorgeous. So a lot of times the men would have to be the 10 a.m. call, which means going to Actors Equity, which is on 46th Street. You know, a lot of our auditions were at Actors Equity, at the studios there, or at 890 Broadway, which was a big set of dance studios downtown. To sign up for an open call, what you would have to do, in case people don't know, for the dance calls, there would be a sheet up at Equity for a week before the audition. And you would go to Equity and you would sign up for the calls that you wanted to take part in, and it would be in order. The day of the call, a half hour before the audition, moderator would call the list in order, and if you were there at the time they called your name, you raised your hand, said here, and they gave you a card with a number on it. You're number one, you're number three, you're number seven, you're number 12. If you weren't there when your name was called and you showed up 10 minutes later, well, you're number 68, you're number 102, you're number 120. So you tried to be there on time and they would just call your number. Guys, for the most part, I have to say, we were so supportive. We would go in groups of 20 or 30, depending on what the choreographer, the casting people wanted to do. You would dance and we would learn it together. And we weren't, you know, you look at like the movie Showgirls and they're all so evil and kind of bitchy, and the guys weren't ever like that. I'm so proud of the guys. Straight or gay, we support each other. Like a group of guys would dance and we'd all applaud for each other. Another group would dance, we'd applaud. I would stand on the side, and I got to know so many dancers who ended up being, you know, a big deal on Broadway. And in fact, like Andy Blankenbuehler, who is the choreographer of Hamilton and In the Heights, 4 or 5 years into my years in New York, he moved there. And I remember being in the changing room after an audition. He'd gotten cut. I'd gotten cut. He was frustrated. I remember him like throwing his dance shoes in his bag, and he knew he was good. And I didn't know him from Adam. And I remember telling him, I knew his name because I heard it called. I said, Andy, you don't know me. My name is Randy. And just don't let any of this get to you. It's going to happen. You're talented. Just don't worry about it. Do not worry about it. Just keep showing up. The people who show up are talented, get there, and you're going to get there. And he ended up doing several Broadway shows, and then he choreographed In the Heights, which he won a Tony Award for. Then he choreographed Hamilton, and he has more money than God. But the guys would be really supportive. I heard stories that, like, and I don't mean to color female dancers that I don't know or anything, but I just heard that the guys, it was nice to be in. Girls would come to the guys' auditions if they couldn't come in the afternoon, and girls would say, "Oh my God, you guys are nice." Like, y'all are not. I didn't know there was a difference. But guys, there was a camaraderie. And for the most part, you didn't sit there and look at other guys as your competition. Because depending on what the show needed, maybe they needed older guys and I'm 21 auditioning. Maybe it was Dream Girls and they needed only one or two white guys and I'm a little blonde boy from Texas. Sometimes you didn't know what they were looking for. And so you just went, you auditioned. Either they wanted you or they didn't. And what I had to learn to do was not make this about me and my talent and constantly question myself. You had to go do your best and let it go. And when someone else got something, you were happy for them. You just went, oh, good for them. And they're good. So now they won't be in auditions with me. Yeah. I'm kidding. But no, yeah, there was a camaraderie that I really appreciate, especially among dancers. Now, not so much maybe among other parts of the musical theater world, like singers or actors, but dancers, I guess it's because we sweat in class together. I used to have this theory about the difference between the way singers and actors work or view their work and dancers. And this isn't a judgmental thing, but dancers are raised. We're brought up in the world at the bar, doing a ballet bar, doing class. We're taught to do what we're told. We're taught to fit in and look like everyone else in the mirror. And singers are taught to be soloists. Like when you go to a concert, singers stand in the bow of a piano and they're soloists. You want to be downstage center by yourself. When you're an actor, you do a monologue and you're by yourself and you want to stand out. Dancers, the basis of our artistry is to fit in and do what we're told. And so in a way, it becomes a different way of approaching the work, depending on the show, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. You know, sometimes you need to be raised in an environment where you need to strive for standing out and being a star and everything. But when it comes to being a dancer, that wasn't the case. It was about fitting in and being the vision of what the choreographer looked like and stuff.
Tell me about the national tour of Cats. What was that like? This is your first big job. What was that like?
Twice in my life, lightning struck. The first time was Cats. I was saved from poverty, and I'm a principal in Cats. People may not know this, but there's like, in my company, there are 20 cats and 12 understudies, and I was the magical Mr. Mistopheles, and there are six what we call principals in Cats: the magical Mr. Mistopheles, Munka's Trap, Gus, Deuteronomy, Grisabella, and the Rum Tum Tugger. And they designated that by who in the original Broadway company had two songs. So if you had two songs, you were principal. So I was a principal in a brand new national tour of Cats. And I joke, and I say this with love. I talk about Cats all the time. And anyone listening to this who knows me is waiting for me to say this. I did Cats back when it was a good credit. In 1986, no one had done Cats. It was like there was the Broadway company, the London company, the first national company that sat in Chicago forever, and the LA company. Like, I was the fourth person to like do my role in the world. It was like mind-blowing. The entire tour was sold out a year in advance. So you're 21. We opened in Atlanta. Then we went to Dallas. Then we went to Houston. Then we went to Miami. And we went to Louisville and St. Louis and, God, Denver and all these amazing, amazing, fantastic cities. And we are sold out before we get there. If we were wearing our show jacket walking down the street, people would stop us and say, oh my God, you're in Cats. It was like being in Hamilton today. Believe it or not, it was, excuse me, the shit. And I'm 21 and it's just blowing my mind. I went from being in a six-floor walk-up and barely able to pay my rent. 1 month before Cats happened, I couldn't pay my utilities and I had to go to the Actors Fund of America, which helps everyone, not just actors, but musicians, anyone who works in the theater. The Actors Fund helps everyone. It's a great organization. And I couldn't pay my utilities. And someone said, oh, you should go to the Actors Fund. I said, well, I've never been on Broadway. And they said, doesn't matter. Go to the Actors Fund. I went to the Actors Fund. They said, bring us your utility bills. They paid my utility bills and I didn't freeze. But before Cats happened, that's kind of where I was at. I was waiting tables. I was jumping over snowdrifts. The winter of 1986 was brutal in New York City. I'm jumping over snowdrifts, going to my table waiting job and going to auditions. And suddenly I'm a principal. In a national tour of the hottest show on Broadway, it blew my mind. For two years, people would do the show for a year and quit. And I'm like, you're quitting? Have you lost your mind? But later I would understand, you know, everyone in the world should do a national tour because you see America, especially being young. I got to see all those great cities. And in St. Louis, I would go to the Arch. In Miami, I went to the beach and all these great cities I got to see. And it was great for me as a human being to see other parts of the country and understand and talk to other people. I remember in Washington, D.C., I had this male dresser, straight married guy, who's just the nicest guy in the world. And getting to know him was just amazing. He was a great guy. And I remember being in Philadelphia, I have to tell this story. It was a Sunday. I'd just broken up, or I was breaking up with my first boyfriend who was in the show. It was very rough because we're all, like, when you're in a touring company, you're literally the only people you see. Like, you work with them, you live with them at the hotel, you travel with them, this is it. I'll make this as short as I can. It was a Sunday matinee, and I was just worn out emotionally by this whole thing of breaking up with my first boyfriend. And it was intermission, and we'd just done the Jellicoe Ball, and it's an 8-minute dance number, and I'm fried. I'm sitting backstage in the wings. Everyone's in the dressing rooms, and an usher comes backstage and says, there's a young boy here who would really like to meet the magical Mr. Mistopheles. I'm like, really? Really? And, like, I'm tired. I'm sweating. So I check my makeup to make sure I look decent, and you could go through a stage door in this little vestibule that connected from backstage to the house of the Forest Theater in Philadelphia. And I crawl out on my hands and knees because we're cats, and there's this little boy named Will in a wheelchair. You'll have to cut some of this. There's a little boy in a wheelchair who knows all of the poems to T.S. Eliot's poems that inspired the musical. He loves the magical Mr. Mistopheles. He throws his arms around me and squeezes me so tight that I lose my breath. And his mother's there. And Will just kept saying, oh my God, oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Now, let's go back. 3 minutes ago, I was tired. It was a Sunday matinee. And I'm emotionally fried. And this young boy has reminded me why we really do this. So it was a beautiful moment. I remember I go backstage, and a friend of mine was on for the White Cat that day. She was an understudy, Jill Gounder. Can you believe I remember these names? I don't know why, but they kind of burn yourselves in your memory. And she goes, hey, doll. And I just broke down crying. So the funny postscript to this story is a few months later, the show's closed. I get this letter from Will. His mother sent it, and he's done it on his Mac computer, and he's drawn this graphic thing like we used to do back in the 80s on a Mac computer, and said, hey, Randy, I'm still talking about you. I still have it to this day. And I'm like, oh my God, that is so sweet that he remembers who I am. And it was sent to Katz, and they forwarded it to me. So about 8 years ago, Joey, get ready. There's like this Facebook reunion, like all of the cats, we found each other for the first time because Facebook was newish or something. And we're all kind of chatting and somewhere. And I had posted a picture of this moment because when I got the drawing from Will, his mother included a photo that she took of me with Will. Will finds me on Facebook. He's an adult. He is thriving. He's awesome. And we, to this day, we text each other once a week. He's a great guy in Philadelphia, and I've chatted with him on the phone with his mother. But can you imagine this moment that goes back? You know, I don't mean to get emotional, but to this day, that taught me a lesson about who is out there in the dark. Oh, and the work that you do and how you do it and how it's perceived and the value of it to someone. You know, there I am thinking I'm tired. To this guy, it was the coolest afternoon he'd ever had. And that changed me. Years later, when I would do the national tour of A Chorus Line, and in the finale, next to finale, the 11 o'clock number, What I Did for Love, in the middle of the song, we would all be standing still. We'd look up. We're directed to look up at what is called the second balcony. If there was a second balcony, that's what we're looking at. And I thought of Will every night I did What I Did for Love, because I just thought, one, thank you, God, that I have a job doing what I love to do, because I never took it for granted. I never thought, oh, I'm so great. Oh, I'm so set for life. Oh, this, blah, blah, blah. But two, I thought about, I don't know who's out there, but someone, even though I'm not one of the stars of A Chorus Line, they might be looking at me. Maybe they're connecting with my story.
That's amazing.
And so you learn, even when I was in Hello, Dolly with Carol Channing which is my first Broadway show. And our director, Leroy Reams, who I adore, who's a great Broadway star, Leroy would tell us, kids, you just have to imagine they're looking at you. It's all about you. She's in the red dress, but they're looking at you. And I want phone numbers when you come backstage. I want you to sell it so hard they're going to give you their phone number. You learn to always understand that the audience is looking at you. And in an audience of 2,000 people, maybe 12 are looking at you, but that's 12 people who paid their $60, $80, $100. And it changed my life to know that. That was a huge lesson for me, and I've never forgotten it.
Coming up in part two, Randy's career really takes off, and we're going to get some behind-the-scene information about when he was in the production of Hello, Dolly! With the great Carol Channing, and also when he did a chorus line. But maybe most importantly, the reason that you should tune into part two is, well, in part one, well, what do you think, Randy? What about part one?
Because I'm not really getting into the fun gossipy stuff yet.
Ah, good reason to tune in for part two. That will be coming at the end of August. Meanwhile, we'll be having another episode with Officer Ron, who now is going to start going by Sergeant Ron, and he's going to be talking about his military experience with part one of a 5-part series starting next time, and that will be out for Friday of this week. Meanwhile, if you can find it in your heart to give a vote for An Older Gay Guy Show at the Podcast Awards for 2020, I will leave the information for how to vote down below in the show notes. We only have 2 days to get those votes in. So please, if you're going to vote, now is the time. Meanwhile, my thanks to my sponsor. This episode has been brought to you by AdamMail.com. Your one-stop shopping for all things sexual and enticing. Go to adammale.com, that's ADAMMALE.com, and check out their wonderful inventory. And as a listener to this show, as always, you can get 50% off almost any one item, and that includes free shipping. Just use the coupon code AOGGS at checkout. I will be back in 2 days with the next episode because we are going to be in sweeps, period. My thanks to you folks. Big hugs. Bye for now.